his national government. It was likewise the administration of the Bank of England that was instrumental in provoking this change by asking for budget cuts known to be unacceptable to most of the Labour leaders. Footnote 18, text. The strategic position of the bank was enhanced by the very fact that, had its demands been refused, the necessary loans would not have been forthcoming. In many aspects, post-war France represents a special case. In Germany or England, the strategic position of the central banks was only made use of at last resort. In contrast to this restraint, the Banque de France and the parliamentary government represent the two opposite poles around which the whole social and political life of the nation revolved in the 20s. Several factors worked together to create this situation. The extraordinarily large public debt, which was carried over from the war and which was not wiped out by such a thorough inflation as in Germany, was an adverse condition to start with. It was aggravated by the inability to obtain sufficient tax revenue from the defective system of income taxes, which in itself, a symbol of middle-class selfishness, was effectively supplemented by what was probably the lowest level of tax morality known to modern history. These conditions reduced the government to a state of perpetual dependency upon the bankers, whether for bridging a temporary shortage of cash for some weeks or months, or in order to place new loans. Under these conditions, the help of the Banque de France was indispensable either for discounting the treasury bonds taken over by private banking institutions, for conducting a generous nationwide campaign in favor of new loans through its system of branches, or for procuring a foreign loan. Page 54. The strategic advantage which the chronic difficulties of the government gave to the private regents of the bank, whose attitude was shared by the government-appointed governor, was invariably used whenever an undesirable government had to be outmaneuvered. The story repeats itself over and over again in 1924, 1928, 1932, and 1936. The electorate shows tendencies to the left and puts into power some government combination shaped according to this image. But scarcely had the government begun to develop a timid program of social reform when the crise de confiance, with all the well-known features of the fall in the value of government bonds and the export of gold and foreign exchange, gets into full swing. The government finds it difficult to obtain even short-term credits, and with the depreciation of its long-term credit, the deus ex machina, the new long-term loan, or what is the desire of each successive minister of finance, the conversion of interest rates, is out of the question. With a little help from the governor and regents of the bank, who chastise the wrong set and are prepared to oblige the right set of politicians, the untrustworthy government disappears. La rente goes up and all reforms are forgotten. Footnote 19, text. In the 20s, this system worked fairly smoothly, apart from the fact that in 1928, the Banque de France forced on its own hero, Panquer, footnote 20, text, a much too low stabilizing level for the France, and that this later proved a distinct disadvantage. In the 30s, however, this process of correcting the popular will ran into difficulties. The Banque de France then tried to force its deflationary policy à la outrance on successive political combinations. It succeeded only at a third attempt with the accession of Laval to the premiership. From this time on, the revision of the statute of the bank and the synchronization of its administration with the political leadership became the catchword of the formative period of the Front Populaire. But significantly enough, when the victorious Front Populaire abolished the overlordship of the Banque de France and tried, according to the popular slogan, to transform it into the Banque de la France, it did not have enough power to stop the flight of the France. When the French Republic was already drawing its last breath, the financial community reserved its liberum veto against the government decree powers by prohibiting close scrutiny of the Eternel Mobilisé de la Armée Condé. Footnote 21, text. That is, by refusing to put the principle of exchange control into effect. Paradoxically enough, the enabling act given by Parliament to the Chantemp cabinet on June 30, 1937, footnote 22, text, marks precisely the point at which the private manipulators of the financial apparatus retained their leadership while destroying the political fabric as a whole. Page 55. This act enables the ministry to take all necessary measures but refuses it the most essential means for their execution. In order the ministry to assure the suppression of attempts to undermine public credit, to fight against speculation, to further economic recovery, price control, budget balancing, and without control of exchange, to defend the gold holdings of the Bank of France. France is an extreme case. In no other country was the conflict between political democracy and private command over the sources of credit allowed to develop so far as to lead into the complete breakdown of the whole social organism. Successive devaluation in different countries, the control of foreign commerce and exchange, and the abandonment of the cherished doctrine of budget equilibrium in favor of deficit spending have done away with the dependence of the government upon the whim of private bankers. To a certain extent, the so-called investors strike in the privately owned section of the economy, that is to say, the increasing difficulties in the profitable employment of capital has contributed to this turn of events by establishing exceedingly low interest rates for government loans, especially in the United States. At any rate, the political importance of this change is evident. The government, which has developed into the largest customer of industry, often buying more than 50% of the national output, is today in a strategically much more advantageous position than any other competitor for power. The possibility which always hung in suspense over the head of previous governments in the pre-crisis period that the financial interests might exercise their veto to throw the currency system out of gear now seems remote and perhaps even non-existent. Footnote 23, text. But at the same time, there is apparently a fairly widespread belief that the new system of government spending and the more or less complete abandonment of the doctrine that natural forces may produce recovery is intended to uphold the system of production of wealth by private activity and enterprise. Footnote 24, text. In other words, the abandonment of the supremacy of money as an automatic regulator of social relationships is not supposed to cause a serious break in the scale of social evaluations prevalent in our society. But to what degree the desires which accompany the changes in the relationship between the government and the financial and industrial community may be fulfilled, modified, or entirely thwarted depends upon the relationship between the various social forces and the form they assume under the changed conditions. Page 56. The relationship that persists between the financial community and the government up to the last crisis may illuminate the degree to which political power was exercised in the form of indirect power. The symbols of politics appealed to us with the entire emotional apparatus which we were accustomed to find on the front page of newspapers. Yet for the realities of political power, the evaluation and appreciation, we had to turn to the financial page. We were certain that the deterioration we could see there would rapidly spread to the front page until a change in symbols would re-establish a balance between both. In our day, the balance is definitely shifting in favor of government, marking a worldwide tendency that has been consummated in the authoritarian countries. Fascist authors have been quick to conclude that in these countries, all indirect power has been replaced by direct power. If this transition from indirect to direct power has a more than merely technical meaning, it implies that the antagonism between state and society, and with its the compromise structure of the state, has permanently disappeared in civil affairs, and that there is no longer any contradiction between the social content and the political form of a society. In reality, however, the contradictions continue to prevail unabated, and what changed was only the form and structure of the compromise. The general tendency of this change leads away from the liberalistic form of compromise, which was essentially a delimitation of spheres between the individual and the government, to a compromise among conflicting power groups. This tendency may be illustrated by the shifting emphasis in the ideology of compromise. In the liberalistic period, it was Herbert Spencer who gave an evolutionary superstructure to the doctrine of political compromise. Footnote 25. Text. Political compromise was the vital condition of a society which marched toward ever higher forms. John Morley's, footnote 26, text, distinction between legitimate and illegitimate compromise furnished the specifically liberalistic element. The legitimacy of the compromise, he wrote, consists in the right of the outvoted individual or minority to uphold and advocate publicly the principles which the majority has rejected. The essence of the compromise thus lies in the guarantees of dissent, which is regarded as the guarantee of a liberal system of government. This characteristically individualistic argument, however, recedes in John Stuart Mill's famous Consideration on Representative Government. Footnote 27, text. Here the compromise becomes a group compromise. Mill declares that the very existence of representative government requires it to maintain a balance between capital and labor and their respective satellites. Page 57. His idea of compromise betrays a desire to avoid the possibility of one social group gaining predominance over the others. In general, the justification of the idea of compromise varies with the social and political affiliation of its advocates. One of the last forms of the doctrine is to be found in the Austro-Marxian theory of the provisional equilibrium between the social classes. Footnote 28, text. What was the reality which corresponded to the changing ideology of compromise? In a strict technical sense, the sphere of compromise expanded with the transition from competitive to monopoly capitalism. The growth of huge social units which accompanied the modern industrial process had a dual impact upon organizational developments. While destroying the older, personalized form of association, it prepared the way for an intricate framework of working agreements among the monopolies, which emerged victorious from the liberal